Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Education Subcommittee. It's Thursday, March 15th, 2007, 3 p.m. in hearing room at.
Thursday, March 15th, the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. And today, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 5019, the Oregon Department of Education, continuing from yesterday. And we have Superintendent Castillo and Deputy Superintendent Ed Dennis. And I believe, I'm going to turn over to Superintendent Castillo, and you be the master of ceremonies and tell us what you're going to do.
Thank you, Chair Galizio, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. Today we'd like to continue our presentation, starting out with Deputy Superintendent Ed Dennis, and he'll be talking about the Office of the State Superintendent.
Good afternoon, Chair Galizio, members of the committee. Thank you for a little bit of additional time and allowing me to talk to you about our issues with our vendor Vantage regarding TESA yesterday. Last night I reduced my presentation size and scope in order to allow you to be able to focus more time with Ms. Latini and Mr. Knorr. Also, I'm due back at the state board meeting to give them an update in executive session on legal issues. Looking at our mission statement, every student, every day, a success. Superintendent Castillo borrowed this from the NISA School District after a visit there. And I think we feel that this statement from NISA is very consistent with our agency focus on successful students, quality schools, and accountable systems, which you heard about yesterday. On the next slide, you'll see our flowchart. The three things I want to mention here are, one, that we are focused on continuous improvement. We have streamlined our management structure. Superintendent Castillo mentioned how we reduced the amount of deputy superintendents during her administration. And two, we have roughly the same level of staffing for 2005-2007 as we had for 99-01. And then finally, three, for those that are here or watching, and for all of you, I want to say that I think we have some of the best staff represented on this slide of any state agency in Oregon. On the next slide, we show generally what the Office of Superintendent is responsible for. It's providing leadership for the agency, leadership for the PK-20 component of the education enterprise, identifying and promoting educational best practices, supporting and coordinating with partners, the State Board of Education, governor's staff, very closely work with them, and conducting research to inform decision makers on key policy issues. Also, our office includes the functions of internal audit, communications, and the federal liaison function. As the chief executive of the ODE, the superintendent sets priorities for the agency. As you see on the slide, closing the achievement gap. If there's anything you should know about this superintendent out there, it is that she is passionate about closing that achievement gap. Literacy at every level. Not just getting kids to read by third grade, but expanding literacy all the way up through high school. And that has been a significant cultural shift for educators around the state. But we can demonstrate real progress there. Middle school, high school improvements. Accountability for results, efficient, effective department operations, born out of necessity during the recession, is something that we proudly carry forward, the school and district leadership. What's causing our budget to grow? Well, frankly, it's the usual suspects like employment-related costs, but also the demand for public reporting and accountability is growing. And that's why we're asking for your support for investments like the Assessment 101 and the cross-office data management prop, which would be so appreciated. And while they wouldn't land in our office, they'd land in OACE, our office that Mr. Costi will talk to you about later. Those are key core functions of the department and needed investments. On slide 7, I'll take a few moments here and just go through some of the performance measures that that we're involved with most directly. The Office of the Superintendent provides leadership for all of ODE, and that leadership includes partnering with various offices in ODE to meet our performance measures. For example, Pat Burke, the Chief Policy Advisor, before I go into too much depth, is Pat here? Yeah. Our Chief Policy Advisor in the Office of Superintendent is an integral part of our work increasing the percentage of classes taught by highly qualified teachers. He doesn't do that alone. He works with many others. He works with Dr. Knorr here. Oh, that's good. He works with Dr. Knorr and actually across agencies to do that work, but he's been an essential part of that, and that's performance measure number 14. The Office of the Superintendent is also directly engaged in work to meet various ODE other performance measures. These include number 5, increasing the number of students graduating from high school through a program run by ECMC. It's where we have funds for several high schools that target students who are on the bubble at a little bit of risk. And if those students finish all the way through high school, they'll get scholarships for their freshman and sophomore years in college or post-secondary. And increasing the number and percentage of key public reports released on time. We spend a lot of time working with the rest of the folks in the agency to achieve that goal. And number 19, improving our customer service. Just very briefly looking to talk about some of the things that we've done well, accomplishments and quality improvements. On the next page, the Office of the Superintendent is leading the way in shifting the focus of ODE to one of accountability and leadership. This includes prioritizing data collections and focusing on student success. As we work through the budgeted results process that you heard about yesterday, the staff of the agency recognized that data collection, technology, and accountability needed more focus and better funding. And we made some difficult choices in the last 6 months to reallocate staff resources to better achieve those goals of quality data collection. Other accomplishments in 05, 07, just three things that I want to, one thing I want to talk about when I want to give you three examples. In the era of No Child Left Behind, where the stick has been a tool that we've used pretty heavily as a country, Superintendent Castillo wanted to put more focus on recognizing and promoting best practices. And so I want to tell you just about three things that we do. One, we created an educator talent pool, some of the best and brightest from all around the state in their different disciplines. We have 300 educators that are in that talent pool, and we tell their stories on our website through publications and describe the ways that they're achieving success in the classroom, and also find opportunities for those people to be recognized by state, regional, and national awards, which give them greater platforms to share the way that they're getting things done. Also, another one, community school partnerships. Looking at how cities and counties are making a conscious decision to work together with schools in more targeted ways to serve students' needs. And also, each year, Superintendent Castillo hosts a conference and evening celebration. It draws over 700 people to celebrate schools that are closing that academic achievement gap. The effort is paid for with private funds raised by Superintendent Castillo. And the work to recognize these schools and their best practices is very well regarded by educators, as is the information that ODE is able to share with others about these schools. The information is shared in workshops, websites, media, and in other ways. In fact, I'm going to take just less than 2 minutes here and show you a short video that illustrates one of the ways that we share this information. The school in this video clip is from White City in Southern Oregon. This is a school that many people would be comfortable to lower their expectations for the students that go there, but that doesn't happen there. Please watch.
We have a community that's a bedroom community for Medford, high crime, drug abuse, many single parent households, high poverty. So as far as community, we have a lot of challenges.
Hi, I'm Colleen Smith. We have a program here at White City Elementary that's called the Retail Program. I put shoes on children's feet, give them socks. They don't have a jacket. I make sure they have a jacket.
We have students that come in with language needs. Language is the building block, really the foundation of all learning. And so when we have students come in with limited English experiences, whether that's from a second language family or whether that's from an impoverished family with limited experiences, that creates some real opportunities, but some real challenges as well.
This award means that Mrs. Carpenter's class
is
perfect attended
today. Students want to learn. We believe that strongly. Kids want to come to school, they want to learn, they want to be successful. So many things get in their way sometimes that that's the last thing on their mind is learning. And so if we're able to create this place where everybody wants to be, the students come in, they feel like they belong here, they can settle down and really show us what they know.
when we get the kids here and once we've established our community of learners, and then we can get to the academics and really focus on that. I feel obviously excited for them. You know, I always tell the kids, I'm just here to help you. You know, this is you doing it.
Yeah, you know this one too.
We've aligned our school within grade levels, so grade level teachers can work together to have planning for the curriculum, for field trips. We look at our test scores every year. What do we need to do to improve? What are the areas the kids struggled with, and how can we help with that? We have specific reading block times where, you know, this is reading time. It's important. We're not doing anything else but reading.
You know, there's more hope on staff when kids do better. This is a tough place to be. You have to have a pretty big bag of tricks to teach it. It's challenging, but it's so rewarding as well.
At home, you can't.
So we do videos for the award-winning schools, and we also do interviews, extensive interviews, to understand their story so that we can talk to other schools all around the state about what is it that they're doing at White City Elementary or Vernon Elementary School or wherever it is that others can replicate, and we do them all around the state. And then we do another level of analysis where we look at the commonalities between those schools and promote that in a separate publication so that folks can see, wow, you know, leadership is essential. That reading block that you heard about in the video, that seems to be cut across all of the schools that are achieving this kind of success, that focus on reading. And anyway, it's a great event. At the annual banquet, educators are treated like movie stars as their school video is shown, and everyone present celebrates them and the children that they've reached, taught to read, compute, and in many cases, the lives that they've changed.
If I could interject here for just a minute, Mr. Chair. This year's event is on May 11th, and you're all invited, and we'll make sure that you know all the details.
Perfect. Yeah. Way to have you be invited and not have to pay, but with the new rules, we're not really exactly sure how to get you in. So I mean, you might have to pay. But maybe if you just have to pay for the chicken dinner, that'll be okay. I don't know. On the next slide, I want to just point to two things quickly. The superintendent's office is very proud of the leadership development opportunities we've provided across the state over the last 2 years. One of these big projects includes the State Action for Educational Leadership Project, or SELP, a statewide initiative supported by the Wallace Foundation. This six-year effort has enabled Oregon to strengthen the policy and practice of school and district leadership. And then also, during the State Board's work on the high school diploma recently, our office took the lead on getting solid formal feedback for educators from educators for the board. And that's just a visual of most of the places that we went to with a formalized presentation and a formalized way to collect back feedback. We did over 300 communities, and we got back over 6,000 something forms in feedback, and not to mention a ton that we got on the web and in a more narrative form. That was very helpful for the board, and it will continue to be helpful as they move forward on their diploma implementation work. As we look ahead, 07-09 planned accomplishments and quality improvements, I want to point out that we have work to do in the Oregon School for the Blind, Oregon School for the Deaf. We have some compelling information as a result of the work that the legislature asked us to complete last session, the budget note you put on our budget. And we are preparing to act on that information. So we look forward to accomplishing more there. And also the budgeting results. You've heard some about it, but frankly, it was the first time, and it was a difficult process with a truncated timeline. And we're looking to take that to scale, get a more even understanding across our staff about how to do this work so that we can have even greater buy-in and even better ideas and vision for the future. It's you know, when you go from just your top level managers making all these decisions to, you know, 50 to 75 people in the organization, that first year is going to be with some bumps, and so we're going to fix that. My last slide on our office for 07-09 planned accomplishments, some minor things, but in our communications office, our three largest publications are still in print and paper, and over the next 2 years we plan to move them, the Oregon Standards, the School Directory, and the State Report Card, all to electronic. Secondly, with your support, we'll implement an academic growth model that will increase educators' effectiveness at closing the academic achievement gap and add greater value to all of our assessment work. And also, we plan to help lead Oregon's response during the reauthorization process of the federal No Child Left Behind Act.
And if I can just interject and note that Representative Jensen is ahead of the curve with the moving to paperless communication. Kudos to you, Representative.
Before I'm done with our office and move to the state board, I want to say that we're in a unique position with the No Child Left Behind Act to provide leadership. Susan sits on her board at the national level of her peers, and she's a board member and officer. And so she's interacting at highest levels with all of our OEA, COSA, OSBA here, with those folks at a national level too. And so we're going to have an opportunity to translate some of that here in Oregon and really work with our federal delegation and make some progress there. Now onto the State Board of Education. They would rather be here, and I would rather have them here than me to talk about what they do, but they're meeting right now across the street. So I'm going to just quickly give you the basics. In addition to the superintendent's other responsibilities, her staff, the State Board of Education, and work closely with it and attend all of those meetings. As you know, the governor appoints the members who serve fairly long terms, and this gives the board a great deal of stability and institutional memory. In addition to developing PK through 12 policy, the board also governs our community colleges. The board adopts policy and administrative rules for both ODE and the Department of Community College and Workforce Development and directs staff in that policy work. For the last 2 years, the board has focused Actually, for the last 3 years, the board has been working on the high school diploma work. For the last 2 years, they focused on that work. In January, the board announced its plans to increase the requirements, and these will be phased in over the next 7 years. An implementation advisory task force composed of educators will guide that work. Finally, the board has also joined the State Board of Higher Education to work on issues of alignment and return the focus to the students' needs rather than the institutions. The goal is to make it easy for students to transfer credits from any Oregon institution and be able to better measure how successful we are at meeting the citizens' education needs. This is coming right from the board chair. I'm so glad I have this script because this is him. In terms of board processes, the board has increased access to the board through the posting of all of its meetings materials to the webpage. They live stream their meetings, and they're also archiving those meetings for later viewings. Finally, the board has also integrated the community college and K-12 portions of the agenda to enhance communication across the sectors with the goal of better alignment to make student transition seamless. Office of the Superintendent.
Questions? Comments? Okay.
Great. Don't excuse me a minute.
No, thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Chair, we'd like to move on to the presentation of Dr. Salam Noor, the Assistant Superintendent who heads up the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation, to tell you about the work in that part of the department.
Welcome, Dr. Noor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might real quick. Dr. Noor's has sent a set of replacements. I don't know if you all noticed it, but in front of you there's a set of replacements that actually should replace what goes in the notebook. So he'll be speaking from the version that you actually had handed out to you today.
In the blue.
So it's actually separate.
Separate from the... Okay.
Looks like this.
Gotcha.
Good afternoon, Chair Galizio, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Salam Noor, Assistant Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education, Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation. Thank you for the opportunity to share information with you on office operations and grant and aid. And my presentation will cover these three areas: office operations, office grant and aid, and two policy option packages. I also want to mention that the packet that you have before you has lots of information that I will be referencing throughout my presentation, and will direct you to which pocket it's in. We thought you needed additional information, additional material to read. So. The mission of the office is to provide leadership to Oregon's districts and schools, professional developments for teachers and administrators, and tools for student success. Our goal is that Oregon students receive a quality, appropriate, and relevant education. We also encourage innovation through the management of state and federal grants, which helps districts provide additional educational opportunities for their students. Specific office functions include the development of the academic content standards in 8 areas, including language arts, math, science, social studies, arts, second language, health, and physical education. We also develop knowledge and skills in professional technical education programs. Representative Barnhart yesterday asked about workforce development. This category would fit into workforce development and preparation for students. These areas are arts and communication, health services, natural resource systems, business and management, human resources, and industrial and engineering systems. We're also responsible for the accountability for state and federal requirements. We work with districts on continuous improvement for schools and districts, especially those that do not make adequate yearly progress or report card requirements, those that are low performing or unacceptable, if you will. And generally, we provide services and supports that focus on student achievement and success. The office, as you will see, is recognized, as you will see, is organized into 6 integrated teams that represent the P20 education system with P20 goals and priorities. You've heard quite a bit about the P20 enterprise and this integration that's taking place between K-12 community colleges and universities. Our work is very diverse and covers many state and federal programs and requirements. So rather than listing those separately, we decided to organize them or group them into these 3 categories: accountability, district and school improvement, and private schools and specialized programs. I will be discussing these in more details later in my presentation. These are the main budget drivers. These are the main budget drivers in our office, and as you can see, accountability is a major function, as well as providing quality services and supports to schools and districts. These are very closely tied to the performance measures, and I understand that you're very interested in seeing how the work that we do at the agency affects the agency performance measures. And speaking of performance measures, these are the key performance measures that relate to our work and contribute to increased student achievement. We address those by developing effective accountability measures for state and federal requirements, by providing tools and resources for schools and teachers, expanding opportunities for students such as 2+2, tech prep, college high programs that allow them to earn college credit while in high school, also providing useful data and information to schools and districts to use to inform instruction and make program-related decisions, providing high-quality professional development for teachers and administrators. And again, I will be providing examples of these as I talk about the program areas that we're responsible for. These are our major accomplishments for the 05-07 biennium. We are very proud of these accomplishments and the services we provide to schools and districts. I also want to stress that our work is done in collaboration with teachers and administrators, post-secondary partners, and business and community partners. As you can see, again, accountability, school improvement, alignment of state and federal requirements, efficiencies that we've accomplished in that area we'll be discussing briefly, alignment and connections across education sectors and professional development are focal points for us relative to the work that we do. Let me start with accountability as a major function for our office. The next 3 slides focus on accountability, and what I would like to do is to provide you an example of the work that we do in these areas. The 3 slides, if we can just go through them really quickly, and then I'm going to give you an example that ties all these functions together under the umbrella of accountability. We manage 18 federal programs. And this biennium, this included about 2,900 subgrants to schools and districts throughout the state. And as a result of our responsibility for managing these grants, we perform a variety of functions. And that begins with our interactions with the U.S. Department of Education relative to submitting a state plan that outlines state goals and priorities and how we plan to use these federal funds here in the state of Oregon. We also work with our partners to develop rules governing the use of the funds that we bring into the state, primarily federal funds, and these are the accountability measures based on state and federal requirements. We have an application process that requires districts to submit a plan to us to clearly describe how they will use the funds to improve student achievement. We review applications, including plans and budgets, from 198 school districts on a regular basis. Some of these funds are formula funds. The allocation to the district comes from the U.S. Department of Education, predetermined. Some are competitive. That requires us to develop another process for them to apply for those funds. Throughout this whole process, we provide technical assistance and training to local education agencies, basically schools and districts, on the appropriate use of these funds. We monitor for appropriate expenditures to make sure that the resources are being spent on the intended target and purposes. In the process, we collect data, we review it, we analyze it, and we generate reports that are shared publicly here in the state and reports that we submit to the U.S. Department of Education. And we have performance measures that we have to meet based on the programmatic side of things and the fiscal side of things that we have to report to the U.S. Department of Education on. I mentioned...
Mr. Chair, may I interrupt?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
As you went through that description of what you did as it relates to the grant management, it sounded a lot like, especially it sounds primarily federal grants, it sounds a lot like you're the watchdog or you're the administrator of that federal grant program. I mean, you are checking up on the local 198 districts that may have these grants to make sure they're abiding by the federal laws. Tell me, is that what I'm hearing you say, pretty much?
Yes. Chair Garizio, Senator Starr, you're absolutely right. This is the regulatory function that the department performs relative to those grants, and it's an accountability requirement that comes with the funds. The funds come with strings attached, and this is exactly what the U.S. Department of Education expects us to do. We approach it, however, in a different manner, rather than having this process be regulatory. We try to approach it in a technical assistance format as well, and I will discuss that briefly if I may.
Thank you.
That's a great question, because we are a regulatory agency, and we have an accountability function that we're expected to perform on your behalf and also on the behalf of the federal government and specifically the U.S. Department of Education. However, as we engage in this process of managing these grants, districts have to submit plans to us in order to access those funds. Districts actually are required to submit two sets of plans. State law requires that a district submits a consolidated district improvement plan to the Department of Education. These federal funds require districts to submit a consolidated federal application, and both are really similar in many ways, but one is a state requirement and the other one is a federal requirement. Some schools have to submit additional plans based on additional funding that they receive from the U.S. Department of Education, such as the Carl Perkins Act for Career and Technical Education. In the past, we had districts submit to us separate plans, one to satisfy state requirements, one to satisfy federal requirements, and a disparate other applications. Over the last few years, this is one of the efficiencies that we accomplished. We actually looked at all of these plans, looked at all of their requirements, and we consolidated them into a single application that comes to the Department of Education. In the past, we would get six applications from Salem Kaiser to access their funds. Currently, we receive one application, and in that application, they have to describe their goals, their priorities, strategies for accomplishing these goals, and the emphasis is on student achievement. So they have to demonstrate results associated with those funds and not just an expenditure plan or a budget plan.
Oh, Senator Devlin.
I just wanted to get a clarification and to use an example. And I was going to use an example of one of the smaller grants, just so I could get an idea of what this meant. Under No Child Left Behind title, I guess it's 2D, Enhancing Education Through Technology. We have a total federal budget of $3.2 million for 550,000 students in 198 school districts.
Yeah.
What does that mean, actually, in terms of what you do to monitor that grant?
Absolutely. Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, well, it initially starts with the allocation of the funds to districts. We have to determine who's eligible to receive those funds, and some of these funds are actually competitive, so not all districts apply to access them. But we start with an application process that clearly spells out what's required in the federal law. and we require a plan from the districts on how they're going to accomplish their how they're going to accomplish the intent of the law. Our role would be to determine the allocation, issue the allocation to the district, monitor expenditures associated with that allocation, provide technical assistance and training relative to education technology based on best practice, innovative practices, effective strategies that we know of based here here in Oregon and nationally. So our interaction is regulatory on the one hand, but at the same time, we provide a lot of technical assistance and supports relative to the appropriate uses of these funds and relative to effective practices that districts can learn from. For that program specifically, we have an education technology cadre, which are representatives from school districts throughout the state. We bring them together to provide training. We train them to train others, and we use that as an opportunity to share best practices and to learn about effective strategies around the state.
Follow up. If I took one that was larger, like under the same title, or Title A of that, Teacher and Principal Training and Recruiting Fund, kind of an interesting subject for today, but at $55 million, and you were judging whether they met the federal criteria, and obviously you're judging whether the funds are being accounted for, that's probably a given. Do you assess in any way what their progress is, whether the funds are having an effect that's meeting the federal government's or the department's expectations?
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, absolutely, and we do that through the continuous improvement process. The plan that the district submits to us is clearly describes what their activities will be relative to those funds. When we issue the adequate yearly progress report, we look at their data, and that allows us to interact with the district relative to that data. If they're making progress in terms of student achievement, that is a confirmation to us that they're doing the right things. But if their data tells us that their students are not making progress, we go back to the continuous improvement plan that they submitted to us, and we will ask them to revise it and make some adjustments relative to their practices in all of these federal categories, not just 2A or 2D. For Title 2A specifically, districts tend to use that for professional development for teachers and administrators and for class size reduction. So we allow districts to use those funds for those purposes, but then it is our responsibility to say, show us how the investment in class size reduction is actually improving student achievement. So we ask the tough questions relative to how they're using the funds and how effective they are in using these funds. And right now we're in the process of adding an evaluative component that districts will be able to apply on themselves on a regular basis to determine if they're getting the results that they really intended based on this investment.
Thank you.
The continuous improvement, next one please. The continuous improvement plan is an opportunity for the district to engage in a fairly extensive planning process relative to their goals, their priorities, their strategies for accomplishing these goals. This is an inclusive process of district staff from throughout the district, and also a process to involve the community in determining the district's priorities, goals, and vision. This process will be electronic next year. We're in the process of eliminating the paper submission. Everything will be available electronically, and districts should be able to go in and update their plans on a regular basis and notifies us that they have done so. We also use this for technical assistance and training. When we review plans, when we receive 198 plans, instead of us just reading them, we bring together educators. We bring representatives from districts and schools throughout the state, and we do this on a regional basis, and we give them the opportunity to review each other's plans. They can benefit from this process by learning about some strategies and practices in other places, but also it's an opportunity for them to share what they're doing and expand on their knowledge as well. I also, in your packet, in the first pocket, you will find the continuous improvement planning standards. We have six categories that they have to address, and these have been defined with indicators. That's just something for you to reference.
I can just add something here. This has been a process where, as you know, we've been doing a lot of work on really analyzing how we make systemic changes in our work with the education service districts and in our efforts to try to provide more support or continuing support to our districts on helping them, and really taking a look at overall how we're structured and how we could make some changes to the structure of the Department of Education, ESDs, and districts. And the ESDs have really been very helpful in helping, especially the smaller school districts, with the technical assistance and helping them with this planning process and the professional development opportunities in this planning process. So as we're looking systemically of how we all work together and partner better and be more efficient with all of our staffs and resources and in providing support for districts, this is one process where we really saw that the ESDs could be very helpful to the state in extending our capacity to provide support to districts in this.
I talked a little bit about the monitoring and evaluation activity, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But I just want to remind the committee that this is required by both state and federal law. State law under Division 20, Oregon Administrative Rules, Division 22, requires us to monitor districts to ensure that they are standard districts by state definition. And that allows us to look at the curriculum, the instruction, the assessments, facilities, school safety, and community engagement, for example. And also the federal law requires us to monitor districts to do an on-site to do a monitoring visit to districts once every 3 years. So we, instead of actually having to be on site every 3 years, we developed a process that allows us to do an on-site review and a desk audit. So a district would receive a monitoring visit on site one time, and then we'll just do a desk audit and request additional information from the districts if needed. The monitoring process is fairly extensive also. It's a collaborative process that allows a team from the department to go out, be on site, work with district staff, district level staff, and school level staff, interview teachers, interview community members, and review the programs that they have at that school. And as a result, a report is generated that identifies findings and commendations, because we use that as an opportunity to recognize the good work that districts are doing. But the report goes directly to the district. The district has an opportunity to respond to the findings, and they have a period of time to start making corrections. And we work with them throughout that process to provide technical assistance and support and guidance and help them come into compliance. And that is a federal requirement again. The next area that I would like to share with you is the district and school improvement category. And it deals really specifically with teaching and learning teaching and learning to standards. And as we all know, teaching and learning is what education is about, and that requires the establishment of clear, quality, and rigorous academic content standards that clearly define what students should know and be able to do at every grade level, and primarily as they exit high school. The standards newspaper in your packet has a list of all of the content area standards in the state, and this is something that's distributed annually to every single school and every teacher in the state, and it's very popular. Our post-secondary partners actually use it in their teacher education programs as well, and I encourage you to look at it at your convenience. We are responsible for the development, review, and revision of the Oregon content standards by state law, and this is done in collaboration with K-12 partners, post-secondary partners, business partners, and community partners. This is done in content and assessment panels that brings together teachers in subject areas. For example, it'll bring together teachers in social studies, in elementary, middle, high school. We involve post-secondary faculty that teach in that discipline, and together they determine the content standards, what students should be able to do, what students should know and be able to do at every grade level. Currently, we have a contract with West Ed, a contractor out of San Francisco, to review the Oregon content standards in all subject areas, including rigor, sufficiency, alignment with state assessments, and alignment with post-secondary general education requirements. This is the first study of this scope in 10 years, and it should give us a lot of information about our standards, how good they are, how they compare to other state standards and national standards, and we're very excited about that review. I meant to talk earlier about how some of this work actually ties to the performance measures, and we believe that many of the functions that we perform under accountability or under teaching and learning tie to the student achievement the student achievement performance measures and its indicators. Having clear, rigorous, and relevant standards will increase student achievement and will actually enable teachers to better use the standards and incorporate them into their curriculum. Also, having standards that are aligned with post-secondary entrance requirements and post-secondary proficiencies will help students be better prepared to transition to college. So the alignment is really critical and will facilitate smooth transition from one sector to the next. Also, the research says that high standards and high expectations for all students will improve low-performing schools, and this work contributes directly to closing the achievement gap that we have in the state, and that's a priority for the superintendent. Another example of district and school improvement is the work we're doing on P20 redesign and alignment between K-12 and post-secondary education. We work with the Joint Boards of Education, which is the State Board of Education that's responsible for K-12 and community colleges, and the Board of Higher Education to connect and align sectors to serve students better and to prepare them to successfully transition to college and the workplace for that matter. Currently, we have a joint boards committee called the Unified Education Enterprise, and they're working on issues such as alignment of standards and assessments, alignment of pathways, and having common career pathways for students to go from high school to post-secondary education, development of accelerated learning options for high school students. They're looking at college opportunities for students while they're in high school, alignment of guidance and student advising systems. They want to have a portal that allows students to go to and be able to access information about all the post-secondary institutions in the state, and common data systems, and Doug Costi will be discussing data systems with you as well, the KITS initiative in particular. We feel that this work contributes to the high school graduation benchmark or performance measure. When students understand the options that are available to them and they're in a track that allows them to see how their courses, how their program of study actually aligns and connects with post-secondary education, they get excited about their education, they stay in high school and graduate, and of course this increases their readiness to do college-level work as they move on to the next step.
Mr. Chair. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Can we go back just one slide to 11? I just had a quick question. You there's a bullet point here you didn't hit on. The Spanish, Russian, Vietnamese translations. Is that saying that you translate this into those languages? Is that what that says?
And Chair Benicio, Senator Starr, yes, that is correct. In addition to English, the newspaper is available in Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese because these are the commonly spoken languages in Oregon schools besides English. And it's available online.
So. Mr. Chair, follow up. What's the criteria about which language? I mean, there's, I don't know, 50 languages that are spoken in Oregon. Yeah. What's the cutoff point? What percentage of the... And again, I guess the audience is primarily the teaching community, so what percentage of the teaching community teaches in those languages? And I'm just curious to know why you go to the expense. I mean, I think mostly we're teaching kids in English. Maybe the teachers speak these other languages, but if you can talk a little bit about that, I'd like some more information.
Absolutely, Chair Galizio, Senator Starr. The reason we chose those three languages, because when you look at that, you're absolutely right, first of all. Some districts have more than 25, 30, 40 languages spoken in their community. But when we looked at the concentration of students that have other than English, a second language other than English, it was primarily in Spanish, Vietnamese, and Russian. And since we have so that's why the justification for actually doing it in these three languages. And we have a large Spanish population in the state that's continuing to grow, and this may facilitate some resources for them relative to the content standards, because we expect students to learn English, but at the same time we want them to learn the content standards, the content of all the subject matters that they're responsible for, because they're required to take state tests and perform well on those tests. So this is a tool, it's a resource to help these students in particular achieve language proficiency, but also to have the knowledge and skills to do well on state tests.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I guess I'm a little confused. Is the primary audience of this publication then students, or is it teachers? Because it was my impression that this was primarily for teachers, and I would guess that the teachers primarily are teaching in English.
Right.
How many of the students are going online to look at the Oregon Standards newspaper?
That's, yeah.
If I could start on the answer, Mr. Chair and Senator Starr. There are some schools that post this in their buildings so that everybody who walks in their buildings know what the standards are. And they want their community and their parents and visitors to the school to know what our standards are, what we expect our students to know and be able to do at each grade level and each subject area. So they really are for wider use. We make sure that all of our educators, of course, have them. But they really are for everyone to know and understand what it is our schools are working towards and what our students are working towards. We love it when parents grab hold of these and really have a deeper understanding of what it is we're doing in our schools so they understand, you know, what's happening for their students along the way. So they really are for wider use, but you're right, primarily, I mean, we want to make sure that all of our educators have them. And so with the diversity and the growing diversity in our schools, we just want to make sure that we are communicating well, and we know that when we do a good job of communicating to all parents and community members, that you know, then we do have more engagement and more success rate in our schools when we do a good job of that. So it's another effort for us to just reach out to more people and helping them understand what's going on in Oregon's public schools.
So that answers the question. It's a broader audience. It's not just targeted to educators. No? Thank you.
Great. The next slide under this category deals with closing the achievement gap, and as Ed Dennis mentioned earlier, this is a priority for Superintendent Castillo, and we're seeing it become a priority for the state as well. Helping schools and districts identify achievement gaps and developing effective strategies for closing those gaps is critical to ensuring that all students are successful, and I believe having a newspaper in multiple languages may assist in that effort as well. We have student-level data and information that tells us how each student is performing in school. We're also able to use this data to identify student groups that are struggling the most and thus need additional assistance and support. The department provides a great deal of leadership for this work and draws attention to the issues surrounding the achievement gap. Although we have seen an improvement in the performance of Black and Latino students in our state, but the gap continues, the gap persists. So we have a lot of work to do in that area. Some of the things that we do in helping schools close the achievement gap is provide training to educators on instructional strategies for ELL students in particular. We provide data workshops to improve database decision making, helping schools and districts look at their data, analyze the data, interpret it, and use it for instructional purposes. Make available database tools to identify students in the achievement gaps, because you have to identify these students in order to be able to serve them. Part of our accountability function is to ensure that these funds are used for the intended purposes, which is to support disadvantaged students in need of additional assistance. Our professional development institutes, such as Closing the Achievement Gap conference that you heard about earlier, is one strategy to disseminate best practices and get schools to share the good things that they are doing in this regard. We also offer regional workshops in collaboration with ESDs on strategies for overcoming the achievement gap, focusing on key factors that impact student learning, such as poverty, socioeconomic conditions, language, literacy, parent engagement, and a host of other variables. Also, Superintendent talked a little bit about the banquet, and that's where we recognize schools and educators making progress in closing the achievement gap. I don't know if you want to add anything else to that, Susan.
I did talk to you about the events coming up on May 11th, and we'll be extending an invitation to all of you, but it really is a wonderful celebration of great work that is happening in schools across the state, and they also serve as laboratories or you know, best practices examples for other schools, and we know that by shining a light on the great work on these schools, other schools then go to visit, and they learn about the best practices that these schools that are being so successful at closing the gap, and it really is a way for us to just spread and take leadership in spreading best practices across the state and helping to provide support for that. And it's very, very hard work on closing the academic achievement gap, and these teachers very much appreciate that we celebrate the great work that they're doing and do the statewide recognition every year.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Castillo, Dr. Noor. I'm curious if the federal monies attached to the No Child Left Behind programs are sufficient to meet the mandates of the Act.
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, no. It has never been fully funded, and we have continually worked with our federal delegation, and they have been working on our behalf, trying to work on that, and then working with our colleagues across the country on really trying to make the case for why we do need more support to have a successful implementation of No Child Left Behind. And so as we have this reauthorization opportunity, those conversations are very much front and center with the federal government.
Mr. Chair, follow up. So to what extent do you estimate the state is subsidizing the implementation of No Child Left Behind?
Chair Galizio, Representative Edwards, we really don't have specific figures relative to that. We can try to get you something, but it's really hard to get your finger on the specific cost for implementing No Child Left Behind in the state. We do acknowledge that it's underfunded, and additional resources would be wonderful to expand the programs and services that are available for students, but we really don't have a specific figure to provide you. But we can do some work on that and see what we can come up with.
Mr. Chair, a quick follow-up. I don't want to burden you with too much additional work, but if you could simply provide me with a figure that represents the percentage of underfunding based on current federal allocations, that would be sufficient.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sounds like a burden. So, Representative Morgan.
Thank you. With relation to the money that the federal government gives the states for No Child Left Behind, how is that allocated? Is it on a per student basis, or does each state just get some random amount of money?
Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, it is allocated on a per student basis. The allocation comes directly from the U.S. Department of Education to us. It's based on census data. It's based on poverty and students, and students in poverty and the socioeconomic status of these students. So it is allocated on a formula basis. In fact, the individual district allocation under Title I, for example, comes directly to us from the U.S. Department of Education. Then we distribute the funds and manage them and administer them. But it is primarily on student data.
So it's a weighted measure. They weight various aspects by state, or they must be by state, not by student.
Yes, Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, it is by state, and typically Oregon receives about 1% of the allocation, but that's determined based on the number of students in poverty that we have in the state and the census data.
So if you were to rank the states by the actual funding per student that they get, where does Oregon rank in the national ranking?
Chair Galizio, Representative Morgan, that's really a good question, and I need to get you some information on it, because if you're looking at state spending or federal spending or both, but we can get you some information on that.
I think that one of the issues that we always deal with in this arena are the federal mandates that come down without the appropriate funding. Special education is one that we've been working on or grumbling about or trying to do something about ever since I've been in this building, and tremendously unfunded mandate from the federal government that impacts us. And I think it would be interesting to see if the distribution that the federal government does for No Child Left Behind is really equitable to the number of students that we're working with, and also I know the challenges that the programs presented in terms of highly qualified teachers and getting people to the place or getting teachers to the place where they fit those requirements, and then the testing, the cost of the testing requirements have been quite a burden for the state, as I imagine they've been for all the states. But the paybacks, I think, are also there too. I think that the increase in the standards for teachers have been worthwhile, and the investments in the testing system have also been worthwhile in terms of being able to move the kids through the system in a more streamlined way. But I am curious about whether this is going to end up being the same situation as Medicaid reimbursements are for the state of Oregon, where we are starting out at some level, and then will present problems to us down the road in terms of being able to meet the costs of the program.
Chair Galizia, Representative Morgan, we will see if we can get you that information. I think these are all valid points. And I do agree with you that these funds are actually helping students in the state of Oregon, because when we look at our Title I schools, we see that students in these schools, Title I schools receive a great deal of the funding. Students in these schools perform very well compared to their peers in non-Title I schools. So the additional investment does make a difference. And also, Dennis talked with you earlier about the reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind Act. Superintendent Castillo is an officer of the Council for State School. Can't talk today. I am sorry. Chief State
Council
Schools
of
Officers.
Chief State
yes.
School Officers.
Yes. And they will be working with the U.S. Department of Education on the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, and they're asking the states to contribute to their work, and they're learning from our individual experiences.
Absolutely. The workload associated with No Child Left Behind, just in the collection of data alone, has just greatly increased not only the workload at the state level, at the agency level, but for our school districts. Their collection of data, the demands on them really went up under the mandates of No Child Left Behind as well. So as we move forward together across this country, all the states working together on our various challenges, we have put together a national, very strong national message. All of the education national organizations are working together on trying to get all of these issues addressed under the reauthorization, and in the next budget cycle, trying to help Congress understand how they could help us with having a more successful implementation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel compelled to follow up a little bit on this topic that we're on. Follow up on it in an area that I don't think has really been covered that too well yet. But in the process, it's been, I think, implied that and maybe not implied, I think it's a direct statement, that the state is basically subsidizing the federal government in the implementation of this plan, because the state is underfunded by what the federal government agreed to. By the same token, I think there's an extension of this to the mandates that are handed down to 16R or whatever other school district that members here might represent, that additionally the funding has not been by the state adequate to meet the needs of the people who are there delivering the service to our children. So I guess the bottom line, to me comes out that the subsidy is not by the state to the federal government sort of thing, because I don't see that flow through of money. As I've looked at education, the subsidy is by the teachers or other educators who are delivering the service on the ground, or you could carry that subsidy out just a little further if you want to and get to the real root of the problem. The subsidy is with the young people in this state who are being subjected to this pass the buck, if you please, from Washington to the state to the local district to the teacher, and the teacher to the student. And that's who's paying the bill on this. Thank you for my dad.
No, well deserved. Senator Devlin, and then Senator Morse.
Just a very quick request, actually. You said in terms of the dollars that No Child Left Behind gave your state, that they went to certain targeted populations within schools, and that they used the criteria to weight that. Could we get a copy of the criteria? Because I'm interested to see how they weighted various factors compared to how we weighted various factors.
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, I think weight in the traditional sense that we would apply to the Oregon formula is slightly different, I think, at the federal government. It's an allocation that comes to the state based on students in poverty and based on census data. So they look at the number of students that live in poverty, they look at the number of English language learners we have in the state, and the allocation is based on that. But we will look into the mechanism that the federal government uses to determine that allocation, and we will provide you that information.
It's also weighted based on which members of Congress are on which committees.
That's
right?
What we were
saying. That's
right. We want to see Senator Byrd's.
Yeah, that's right. West Virginia. West Virginia does quite well under the formula.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question in a little different vein. Thinking of your regulatory function and this overall governance structure that we have in K-12, this is something that's bothered me for quite some time. So we have local units, you know, local districts and boards and superintendents and that structure of local governance. And then the overlay with state, and then, of course, again, the overlay with the federal government. How do you relate to schools that are underperforming? And as I look at the key performance measurements that are proposed, actually on page 6, I see two that you actually can control out of the, what, there's 10 there listed. The rest of them are local governance issues. And from a regulatory perspective, how does this work for schools that don't meet these standards that you have set?
Chair Galizio, Senator Morris, that's really a great question, and it deals specifically with accountability and having multiple systems of accountability. And one of the goals that Superintendent Castillo has is really the establishment of a single accountability system that has common measures that we can apply to both the federal performance measures and the state performance measures. If you recall, Dr. Burke yesterday mentioned the Oregon report card, and based on the school report card, we determine if a school is outstanding or if they're low performing or unacceptable based on a number of variables. That allows us to allows for a number of intervention measures, primarily asking the school to submit a plan to the Department of Education on how they're going to improve their practices and the services that they provide to their students and how they anticipate to make progress relative to the areas that they've been identified to be deficient in. On the federal side, we are required to provide an intervention model for schools and districts that do not make adequate yearly progress, especially if they persist in that category. For schools that fall into school improvement, they have to, based on how they anticipate to make progress relative to the areas that they've been identified to be deficient in. On the federal side, we are required to provide an intervention model for schools and districts that do not make adequate yearly progress, especially if they persist in that category. For schools that fall into school improvement, they have to, based on the federal sanctions, they have to offer a choice to their students to go to another school. Or in the second year, they have to offer supplemental services to their students. And if their status continues, they go into restructuring or corrective actions that requires much more extensive interventions on our part. So we're trying to bring these two systems together so we provide support to all schools, regardless whether they receive federal funds or not. But the interventions that we provide involves the district submitting a new plan to the Department of Education on how they're going to improve their practices and how they're going to increase student achievement. There is a time frame that they have to do it in. It may require some monitoring on our part. It will certainly require some technical assistance. In some cases, we may pair some districts together, districts that are underperforming and districts that are excelling, so they can learn from each other. So we try and craft a number of strategies to help districts learn from one another and improve their practices. On the federal side, we have a regional intervention model that we're working on currently with Education Service Districts and the Northwest Regional Education Lab, where we bring schools that are in school improvement together. We provide training on effective planning. We provide training on data analysis and interpretation and how you use it to improve instruction and make decisions, and a variety of other strategies that are aimed at improving student achievement. But you're right, we have two types of interventions. One is more extensive than the other. If schools continue to remain in improvement status, the federal law requires some severe actions on their part, which may mean restructuring the school, reconfiguring the school, replacing the staff, replacing the principal, revamping the entire curriculum. So there are some severe sanctions on the federal side.
Those are only for the Title
I. Yes, those are for Title I schools. Thank you, Susan. To clarify, those are for schools that are receiving federal funds, Title I schools specifically.
Thank you.
Chair Galizio, I know you were trying to fit two of us today, and I'm trying to rush through this presentation as much as I can to accommodate my colleague, Nancy Latini. So I'm going to try and get through some of these slides fairly quickly and then give you the opportunity to ask some questions and I can elaborate. Another effective strategy for us on district and school improvement is the literacy initiative. You heard a little bit about that earlier from Superintendent Castillo and Ed Dennis. We recognize that reading is a critical skill, and if students cannot read, they cannot learn. That becomes a tremendous disadvantage to them if they are not proficient readers by grade as they advance through the educational system. One of our key strategies in this area was the formation of the Literacy Leadership State Steering Committee, which is comprised of K-12 educators and education partners such as COSA, OSBA, OEA, and many others. We have post-secondary partners both from private schools and public schools, community partners, business partners. The legislature is also a partner. Senator Walker sits on that committee, and a host of other stakeholders that are interested in literacy. This group has accomplished a great deal over the last couple of years. They're developing a comprehensive statewide plan for K-12 literacy. Our emphasis tends to be on K-3, but they're making a deliberate effort to focus on adolescent literacy in middle and high schools in particular. And this plan will inform literacy development across the state. It will provide a general framework that districts can use to inform their own specific literacy initiatives and efforts. We provide a lot of professional development in this area. We offered over 17 literacy training, reaching over 1,000 teachers and administrators this last biennium. We also offer a key professional development opportunity through the Literacy Institute, which is held in the summer. In 2005, we had 500 participants. They come as teams from middle schools and high schools, and sometimes we would have 5 or 6 teams from a district representing different schools. We had 500 participants in 2005. We had about 850 in the 2006 Summer Institute, and this year's Institute will be a partnership between COSA, OSBA, OEA, and we're anticipating about 1,200 participants to come from schools throughout the state. In your packet, pocket number 4 has information on the literacy work that we've been doing, and the 5th pocket, number 5, has information on the Literacy Institute that will be offered this summer. And we're very excited about these professional development opportunities because they are really focusing on increasing students' ability to read, and that increases their ability to navigate through the education system and to learn. We also provide a variety of tools and resources that districts can use on their own. Again, I believe this work and the accountability work relates to student achievement, and also literacy is one of the reading is one of the factors sometimes that keeps districts from making adequate yearly progress. So by improving the literacy capabilities of students at a district level, their students will perform better on the state exams and they will be able to make adequate yearly progress, and that also contributes to closing the achievement gap. Slide 15 deals with professional development, and I provided you with some examples of that, but we also offer subject-specific professional development where we work with teachers in math, science, language arts, arts education in collaboration with teacher associations, education and business and community partners to provide focused professional development related to that discipline. We offer a variety of school improvement institutes for schools and districts that are in school improvement, and those are focused on planning, looking at data, making specific plans, and taking action to improve student achievements. And we provide training relative to the use of the funds to ensure that their the fidelity in the implementation. The next slides deal with an interesting category because we are not, we're, you know, we serve K-12 primarily, but we also have a responsibility for private career schools. So we've lumped private career schools and the various alternative education options available to students, such as alternative education programs, private and public, charter schools, homeschooling, and a host of other opportunities under this category. And what I would say is that that alternative education and some of these options are not considered mainstream, but we're really seeing a proliferation of them across the state. We have about 212 public alternative education programs, 94 private alternative programs, and 70 charter schools. And all together, they're providing some viable educational options and opportunities for our students. Again, our role ranges from accountability to technical assistance and support and management of grant dollars associated with some of these activities, such as the charter school funds.
under the private career schools category, our function is primarily to establish minimum standards concerning the quality of the education that these institutions offer, ethical business practices, health and safety, and fiscal responsibility of private career schools. It is primarily a monitoring and an accountability function. We discussed briefly some of the grant and aid programs and how these funds are to be used by schools and districts throughout the state. Just want to mention again that we have 18 programs. 14 of those are No Child Left Behind programs. Two of them are under the Carl Perkins Act for Career and Technical Education. We have a Service Learning Program, an Advanced Placement Incentive Program, and a Test Fee Program. Those come together, otherwise it would be a total of 19. Combined, these programs add up to approximately $450 million that's distributed to local schools and districts throughout the state.
Dr. Moore, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just before you go any further, on the private career schools, you know, you've been talking all about content standards and testing and that kind of accountability. To what extent does that exist for these private career schools? I mean, I see that you have minimum standards concerning health and safety, ethical business, but to what extent, comparatively to, let's say, yeah, public institutions that would normally think.
Absolutely. Chair Galizio, I think our involvement is really minimal related to the curriculum that they offer. Many of the private career schools fall under national standards that they have to meet. There are accrediting institutions and licensing institutions, for example. If a private career school wants to offer a program in dental assisting, there is a dental assisting board here at the state level that oversees the content of that program. Our responsibility is to monitor them for operational purposes to ensure that they have a comprehensive educational program as they advertised, and that students are not disadvantaged in any of the in that experience.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm sorry. It's a little slow.
Okay. What I wanted to mention about the $450 million, that this is based on the governor's budget, and if the federal numbers change, we may have to adjust that, and we'll make sure that we update the documents that you have. Under the accountability, our major accomplishments under the grant and aid section are listed before you. I won't go over them in the interest of time. But again, our accountability function is really critical to these grant and aid programs and the support systems and technical assistance that we provide to schools and districts. The next three slides describe the various programs of the No Child Left Behind Act. And in your packet, in the last pocket, the eighth pocket, there's an expanded document that gives you a much more detailed description of what these programs are about. So rather than go through them each, I would like to give you a few examples of how these funds are used by schools throughout the state. They will illustrate the relationship. Also, I have another document that will illustrate the relationship between the Department of Education and how these funds are distributed to schools and districts. We did a mock-up profile of a district that shows the number of students that they have and the various funding sources that they would receive from the department. This is just a sample for you to use. And you'll see the extent of the funding that they receive from us, and this determines the type of interactions and the relationships that we have with them. But Title I funds specifically are used to provide supplemental reading instruction for students. Some districts use them to supplement their full-day kindergarten programs. Some provide educational programs for migrant students, and they're specifically designed for that purpose under Title I-C. Some provide targeted strategies for at-risk youth and dropouts, and the intent is to recapture them and assist them in finishing high school. And some of these funds are directed to help schools engage in school-wide planning, and that's connected to the continuous improvement plan that I discussed earlier. So moving quickly through some of these Title funds, Title II funds, as I mentioned earlier, are used primarily for professional development for school and district staff, for class size reduction. The Math and Science Partnership Act is a competitive grant, and it allows for the development of a partnership between K-12 institutions and post-secondary institutions to increase student achievement in math and science. And Title IID, we discussed earlier, it's about enhancing student achievement through the use of technology. What's unique about these programs is that they focus on instruction. They want to directly impact instruction and the instructional strategies that students use. Title III is
It's used primarily to help English language learners develop their English language skills and also to assist them in acquiring the content in the various disciplines. And the standards newspaper, as we discussed earlier, the one that's available in Spanish, for example, would be really helpful for students that are learning English and also want to understand how the standards relate to the courses and the experience that they're involved in. So I'm going to skip through and get to Carl Perkins. In addition to the academic side of the curriculum, Carl Perkins provides opportunities for students to learn about to learn academic content and also career and technical content in six areas. And I mentioned those earlier. There are arts and communication, health services, industrial and engineering, human resources, natural resource systems, for example. We have about 1,100 secondary programs in the state and 1,500 community college programs, and we work very hard to connect those and make sure they articulate with one another. And the emphasis, again, is on academic achievement of students in career technical areas, as well as the skills that will help them enter into the workforce. In addition to these programs, Perkins funds support 2+2 programs that allow students to earn college credit in high school and articulate 2 years of high school with 2 years of a college education, primarily with community colleges. We have 8,000 students in the states that have earned over 33,000 college credits during this biennium. The Advanced Placement Incentive Program is a new program in the state, and we're very excited about the results that we're seeing from it. It provides resources for high-poverty high schools to provide income-eligible students opportunities to access advanced placement international baccalaureate programs in high school. The focus is on rural, high-poverty schools and schools in school improvement status, as we discussed earlier. And it provides opportunities for students that typically don't really pay attention to advanced placement or international baccalaureate programs in high school, and it expands their educational experience to include a college experience as well, and that really opens the doors for a lot of these students to consider college as an option for the first time. I have some of that information in your packet in pocket number 7 that shows you the amount of funds that we receive for the program, the goals, and the outcomes that we're striving for. But to give you an example, under the TESPE program, which pays for income-eligible students to take the AP exam, we're seeing a surge of the number of students that are actually participating in that program. In 2001, for example, 163 low-income students used the TESPE program for AP exams. In 2006, as a result of the funds that we have and as a result of the opportunities that are available for students, we saw that number jump to 867 low-income students used the TESPE program for AP exams. And we're very excited about these results and the opportunities that it's opening up for students. Some just overall performance results.
And excuse me, Dr. Norris, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if we know anything about the results that those students achieved. Were they able to get some college credits through the AP exam process?
Chair Galizio, Representative Barnhart, yes, absolutely. For those of them that score a 3 and above are eligible to get college credit. We don't, since the data is new and we've only been collecting data for about a year or so relative to this new grant that we received, we don't have longitudinal data yet, but that's a great question and we probably should include it as part of our performance measures relative to how this is helping students advance to the next stage in their education.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. So you don't know yet whether any of these students actually received college credit or not?
Chair Galizio, Representative Barnhart, we know that a significant number of them did, but we can get you some numbers to help you.
I think what you said already is very helpful. Thank you.
And if I could add, the College Board was quite pleased to see Oregon's performance on this. They knew that we had one of the largest gains in the country on our efforts to get more low-income students taking AP courses, and so we have been working very hard. This grant has been very helpful to us in our outreach.
If I may add to that, in 2001, for example, 4,900 students took the AP exam. In 2006, we had 8,500 students taking the AP exam, and we do know some of them are getting college credits, but we'll look into the data and see what we can provide you as well. The last two slides deal specifically with the policy option packages. The civics policy option package distributes $75,000 for just for... Thank you.
just for success?
Just for success. I don't have my slide with me, so I'm going to have to look over here. And the intent for it is to allocate $250,000 for those two programs, just for success, $75,000, and $175,000 for civics education, which focuses primarily on professional development for teachers and educators throughout the state relative to civics education. And we are in the process of developing performance measures for this program. It's a new program in our budget, but there is research that supports students' performance and student achievement relative to the CHESS program.
Representative Barnhart, thank you. Very quickly, is that an acronym I haven't heard of, or are we referring to the old board game?
Chair DeLizio, Representative Barnhart, James Sager from the governor's office is here, and he said that he would be willing to speak to this program and provide you some additional details.
I don't need to know that, because I'm a chess player and I understand how chess as a game is actually very useful. But I'm wondering what the term stands for in this context. I'm simply asking for the name.
Jim Sager, Governor's Office. Yeah, that is the name of the program, and it's playing chess, but it's a structured teaching tool to go along with learning how to play chess.
Thank you. I think that's a wonderful idea.
The last slide is Policy Officer Package 358, which is the Teacher Administrator Mentoring Program. This policy option package allows for structured and scientifically based approaches to mentoring and coaching new teachers and administrators so they are successful. We have data to indicate that we lose about 40% of our teachers in the first 5 years of teaching, and that's due to lack of support and not being prepared to deal with the challenges and the rigors of the teaching profession. We have research also that clearly illustrates that teachers are the key variable for student success. So this is a very exciting opportunity for teachers and administrators to engage in mentoring activity that will better equip them to serve students and be effective teachers and administrators. Superintendent Castillo has a priority for leadership in the state, and this will fit very nicely into that context. It's a statewide framework that looks at leadership development, and we're looking at leadership very broadly to look at administrators and teachers. And we believe that this policy option package will contribute to increased student achievement, will address the performance measure on highly qualified teachers and administrators, and will assist schools in closing the achievement gap because if their teachers are better prepared, better qualified, they're better suited to help their students be successful.
Dr. Noor, on the mentoring program, what is the barrier that exists currently that prevents schools and school districts from doing this absent $5 million?
Yeah. Chair Galizio, resources is really the primary barrier. Resources that allow teachers to interact with one another, that allows teachers with a tremendous amount of experience to take the time to mentor new teachers that come into the profession. So that one of the primary barriers is resources, because you have to buy mentors time in order to spend the time with new teachers and administrators.
President Morgan.
I don't know how to say this. My belief is that the problem that we are attempting to address is that we lose a lot of teachers within the first 5 years that they start teaching, that there's a high rate of teachers that just decide for whatever reason not to leave or not to be in the system anymore. So it would seem like it would make sense as a performance measure to track how many teachers leave the system. So I understand why you're using existing performance measures, but I think perhaps the committee should have a discussion around one that directly measures how many teachers are leaving the process and use perhaps this biennium or last biennium as the baseline number and judge if POP is funded, judge the effectiveness on something that's pretty straightforward.
Chair Colizio, Representative Morgan, we know about 30% leave the profession within the first 3 years. And it's a huge cost to districts because they have to go out then and go through the whole process of finding teachers to replace them, not to mention all of the investment that our state has made in their education and training. And we need to keep those teachers in our schools. So this is very a very wise investment, this $5 million, as far as we're concerned, to really help us retain those new teachers and new administrators to help us be more successful in our schools.
Thank you, Senator Stark.
Thank you, Senator. This is a particular investment that I think will pay off big dividends for us. There's a lot of research that has demonstrated that you marry a new teacher with a seasoned teacher and having worked together in these early years, it will pay off. We will keep teachers engaged in the system. The superintendent is absolutely correct. We spend a lot of money training these teachers, and to lose that fresh blood in the first 3 years is very harmful. So this is one investment I think is well worth making. I agree with Representative Morgan as well that, you know, we ought to maybe track this, but I think that there is data out there that's pretty easy to get to determine what's happening here.
So hopefully this is being heard in the room back over there with the co-chairs. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hesitate in light of the glowing comments in relationship to mentoring to say what I'm about to say, but I fear the mentoring program is treating the symptoms, not treating the problem. I think back, I think back in the 1960s when I first became involved in education, and had I looked at the conditions, had I had to look at the conditions that my children who are educators today are faced with, I would have left the system. I move ahead a number of years to when I was teaching at the college level at Blue Mountain, and had I had to deal with the situation there that community college teachers are having to deal with today, at one point in my career when I was forced to make a decision to either pursue my consulting business and drop out of education, or to sell out my consulting business and stay in education, I made the decision to stay in education. There are students who would think I made the wrong choice. I understand that, and I don't want to have to defend that at this particular point. But, you know, the incredible load that has been placed on teachers in the last few years, few by my definition of the situation, staggers me that you get off with no more than 30% of the people leaving the profession. I can't imagine them staying under some of the conditions that we're asking them to work and perform under, the hours that we're asking them to put in to fulfill their obligations. And my colleague on the left jabbed me a little bit about my comments previously, and he can jab me again when I get through with these comments. And I don't have anything against the mentoring program. Please don't misunderstand me. I think there's merit in the idea. I just think we're treating the symptom. We're not treating the problem.
Thank you, Representative Senator Morse.
Thank you. I would echo the Commissioner's comments that mentoring is a wonderful tool. It's been used in the private sector, and I think it's a very excellent tool. But the underlying issue is when you have new teachers that are on food stamps, that may be a greater factor in changing careers than anything else. And
and I was probably asked to be in one of our local schools visiting, and one of the teachers came up. He was a new teacher, and he said, "You need to know I'm on food stamps."
Thanks, Senator Devlin.
I think one of the realities of this, and I understand fully Representative Jensen's comments and Senator Morris's comments, is that one of the reasons on the K-12 level why I think some of the studies that have been done have shown that, so to speak, the programs where you just say, this is the experience, two experienced teachers in the school, they should mentor these three or four people, is the reality of what they've been faced with in terms of challenges, the realities of how many things they have to do, means that that's an almost impossible task under the circumstances they've been put. That's why actually this measure has been structured so that it isn't really doing that. It's actually providing people with their job, in a sense, limited duration, is to be the mentor. And that's an unfortunate sort of commentary on where we are. And I think it would be very beneficial. The thing that I've found that's interesting about this particular proposal is we've had a few issues this session, and I won't comment on some of them, where we've had the education community in complete disagreement. And this is one of the few where I think we have broad support on all of the parties. And actually we have broad bipartisan support and bicameral support. So.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Representative Wyatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I simply wanted to note that if I jabbed Representative Jensen, I apologize. I agree completely with the statements that he's made, both statements. The latter one, even more, if that's possible, than the first one. Let me just add to that that when people are dealing with very, very difficult working situations, as I think many of our new teachers are, they have to get up and running very, very quickly. If they don't, they become demoralized and feel helpless and may believe that their only choice is to go do something else, even though they may turn out to be really great teachers. While this program may not certainly solve our problems, and I certainly will be the last person to say that it does, anything we can do that increases the new teacher's capacity to function in what is a very difficult environment, we ought to do, and the price tag here is extremely modest, and I believe that we already have substantial information that this sort of approach is beneficial. So while I completely agree with the comments others are making about teacher pay and about the relationship between the degeneration of working conditions for teachers for a whole variety of reasons in our schools, absolutely correct. This is something we can do not to solve the problem, but to, looping back to what Representative Jensen said earlier, treat one of the symptoms, and we ought to do it.
Thank you, Representative. Did you have any closing comments, Dr. Thank you, Representative. Did you have any closing comments, Dr. Miller, Superintendent Castillo?
No, Chair, please. Thank you.
Okay. And I just want to take the Chair's prerogative to say thank you to the Superintendent. The idea of, you know, the banquet and honoring and shining the light on successes is, I think, extraordinarily important. And in this era of sort of completely overpaid, you know, movie stars and television people, where we, you know, they have award ceremonies, I think, twice a week. It's nice to, you know, that you've done this to publicly praise teachers and students and administrators, and I think it makes an extraordinary difference, and it perhaps helps to, I think it further encourages people to continue in education. So I just wanted to publicly say thank you. I'm glad you're doing that.
Thank you.
And thank you all very much. So I guess on Monday we'll see Nancy Latini. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5019, and we are adjourned.